Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 26th of January, 2013, as I'm coming to you right now in the morning here in Japan, and we are joined today on the line from Australia by Brock West, the owner and proprietor of APPerspective.net. That's Asia Pacific Perspective, which is a blog that many of you might be familiar with from some of our previous conversations with Brock. And it's our intention to start a new monthly video series going over some of the most important issues from the Asia-Pacific region and some of the big headlines that are breaking on APPerspective.net. So I'm looking forward to this new series. I think that this Asia-Pacific region, as we've talked about before, is becoming more and more important. So we should be keeping our eyes on some of the big stories from the region. So it's great to have you here, Brock. Thank you so much for coming on and doing this.
James, the pleasure's all mine, and I'm very, very excited to be starting this new series with you, which so far we're going to do on a monthly basis. We'll see how it goes from there. Very keen to get into some of the breaking, developing stories that are happening more and more regularly here in the Asia Pacific.
As am I, so why don't we get straight into it? What story do we have up first?
Well, today being Australia Day here, I thought we might as well start with an Australian story. Sadly, it's not a positive one, but anyway, we'll play our way through it. This one comes from computerworld.com.au, and the title is Through a Glass Dimly, Australia's New Cybersecurity Policy. Prime Minister Julia Gillard has announced that $1.46 billion has been set aside by the Australian federal government to strengthen cyber networks as part of a national security strategy. The funding, which will spread out to the year 2020, is designed to strengthen what Gillard describes as Australia's most sensitive networks. In addition, a new Australian Cybersecurity Centre will be established by the end of 2013, which will combine existing cybersecurity capabilities across the Attorney General's Department, Defence, Australian Security Intelligence Organisation, ASIO, the Australian Federal Police and the Australian Crime Commission all in one convenient location. According to Gillard, the centre will provide Australia with an expanded, more agile, responsible response capability to deal with all cyber issues, be they related to government, industry, crime, and or security. James, in the poorly orchestrated sock puppet show that is modern day government worldwide, we've seen time and time again these so-called existential threats put up in front of public as a means of not only controlling and manipulating perceptions, but perhaps more importantly, we've seen the cyber warfare boogeyman being propped up more and more of late. And I believe this is a way, you know, a very clever and stealthy way to not only centralize and streamline its own power, but also to strengthen its capabilities to surveil its populations, not just physically with drones, for example, but of course online as well, because nothing is more terrifying to the ruling oligarchs than a free and open internet. What's your take?
I agree completely, and I think that this is interesting timing on this, coming just after the death of Aaron Swartz there in the U.S., and unfortunately, as Kim.com continues going on with his various enterprises, think what you will of him, I think he's a snake in the grass, and I wouldn't trust him as far as I can throw him, which would probably only be a few inches anyway. So absolutely, this is some interesting timing, and it, of course, is just absolutely dovetailing with all of the other echelon countries, Australia and New Zealand and Canada and England and America, of course, all being of one piece when it comes to these security issues. And I think it, I think we see the parallels in things like the new data center that the NSA is opening up in Utah and things like that that are happening basically all around these echelon countries all at the same time. Funny how that works, isn't it?
Yeah. I was actually going to speak about the NSA database building in Utah, which is still relatively, you know, completely unreported here in Australia anyway, as far as I've seen. Now, look, there could be a legitimate cyber threat from the West political enemies. I think you would have to be somewhat naive to rule that out completely. But, you know, we saw last year with the admission by the Obama administration of the use of Stuxnet and Flame on its enemies in Iran. So we can just see, even just by that one example from last year, how, you know, Western governments are using these tactics to, you know, go after their political enemies, but then also say, oh, we've got these worldwide cyber threats that we need to clamp down on internet freedom, and we need all these new centralized, you know, essentially surveillance cyber centers.
Yes, exactly right. And of course, it's always that boogeyman threat. And of course, it always turns out that when these big, spectacular worms and things can be traced back, they can be traced back to America and Israel and their allies. So absolutely, it's just more hypocrisy. And it, of course, exactly mirrors the hypocrisy that we saw in the war on terror. So I think there should be no surprise there.
No surprises whatsoever. Now, we could talk about this for another couple hours, I'm sure, but let's move on to our second story. And this is the issue that I've been covering mostly on APerspective.net, and that, of course, is the territorial disputes between Japan and China. Both you and I have been covering this quite extensively over the last, 12 months or so. So I would encourage people to go back, check through the archives on APerspective.net and, of course, on CorbettReport.com. But as we're seeing more and more escalations almost every other week now, I'll just take this from an article from Al Jazeera. The title is Japan Warns China Over Airspace Violations. Tokyo's warning comes as China rebukes US for opposing actions that undermine Japan's administration of islands. Japan has said that it may fire warning shots to keep foreign aircraft from violating the airspace over a set of disputed islands in the latest verbal exchange between Tokyo and Beijing. Japanese officials made the comments after Chinese fighter jets recently tailed its warplanes near the islands in what is believed to be the first scrambling of Chinese Air Force jets since tensions began to rise last spring. According to Chinese media, a pair of J-10 fighters were scrambled after Japanese F-15s began tailing a Chinese surveillance plane near the disputed islands in the East China Sea. James, you know, I've covered this a lot. It has a long sorted history. You know, at first there was a bit of a political tit-for-tat between the two former administrations, and now we're seeing the new administrations pretty much doing the same kind of things. We've seen the nationalistic protests, with some of which got violent. We've seen the boycotting of Japanese companies in Japan, which has hurt Japan's already limping economy along. If we put nationalism aside just for a minute here, James, my first question to you is, why do Japan and China seem unable and unwilling to pull themselves out of this kind of stalemate? And from what I've seen, there seems to be very little, if any, real dialogue or diplomacy between them, considering so much is at stake for both sides economically.
Well, that's the real point, isn't it? It's such an economic tie between them at this point that I really still don't believe that either side really wants to start any sort of major confrontation over this. And I think they might have backed themselves into a corner, politically speaking, with this, because I think there was a lot of heated rhetoric going on in the Chinese transition, leadership transition, and the Japanese parliamentary elections. And I think that spilled over into this type of chest-thumping nationalism. And I think that was something that has backed them into that corner and has made it difficult for them to reach out. But actually, interestingly enough, just a couple of days ago, we saw a meeting between the new Chinese leader, Xi Jinping, and a high-ranking Japanese parliamentary official. And during that meeting, the Japanese parliamentary official gave Xi Jinping a personal letter from Shinzo Abe that supposedly contains nothing specifically about the dispute, but just some sort of vague general language about how we should work together on security and things like that. So this was the highest level contact of that kind that there's been in recent months at any rate. And according to the Global Times, which of course is the English language mouthpiece of the Chinese government, now she is taking a softer tone after Abe's personal letter. And it's basically talking about how things might be thawing a little bit on this dispute. But again, they have really backed themselves into a political corner. So I think it remains to be seen whether or not this will actually bear fruit.
That's exactly right. If we kind of also look a little bit broader around the region as well, we've seen not just in over the Senkakus or the Daiyos, whatever side of the sea you're on, but we've also seen many, many other hotspots pretty much on every corner of the Asia Pacific at the moment. And this, it almost instantaneously seemed to start boiling at quite a ferocious rate ever since the Obama administration announced its Asia Pacific pivot, you know, towards the start of last year. You know, we've got the Takeshima / Dokdo Island dispute between South Korea and Japan. We've obviously got the South China Sea dispute, which is still on quite a knife edge between Taiwan, the Philippines, and Vietnam. And there's a rather underreported and almost forgotten dispute that's going on in the north of Japan right now between Russia and Japan over a small group of about three or four islands, I believe. I'll be covering that coming up in the next week on APPerspective.net. So all of these issues do still remain on somewhat of a knife edge. And James, once Team America World Police is fully entrenched and tangled in the region, geopolitically and militarily, do you see a way forward for the region peacefully, or are these kind of squabbles and possible confrontations here to stay for the long run?
Well, they certainly can't be helped by an increasing American military presence in the region, can they? They're certainly just going to inflame some of the tensions that are already here. And I think as we see the American military eye turning towards the Asia-Pacific, we're going to see more of these types of disputes taking sort of front and center on the international stage, where these have been simmering under the surface or even over the surface for quite a long time. But it's just now that I think world attention is really turning to these issues. So I think we're going to see more, not only in terms of military confrontation, but more of a push for some sort of diplomatic resolve to actually do something about, for example, the South China Sea situation. And Russia and Japan, of course, there's been simmering tensions over those northern islands, as you say, for quite a long time. So there is a lot of things going on. And unfortunately, what's stepping into the middle of this is the Korean nuclear situation, which I was just on RT talking about. So it doesn't show signs of abating or dying down anytime soon.
Unfortunately not, James. And this is the reason why I started the website in the first place, to give light to these kind of issues which still are being underreported and are going to become more and more frequent and important geopolitically and for the prosperity of the region as a whole.
Couldn't agree more. Absolutely. It's ahead of the curve to be on these issues.
Certainly is. And we'll take our third and final story today from another issue that is generally, once again, underreported, at least here from what I can tell in the Australian media landscape. And that's India and Pakistan. Now, I know this is not Asia-Pacific per se, however, it still is Asia, and it still is an extremely important issue that needs to be brought to light and spoken of and exposed a little bit more, because we basically have two very highly powerful nuclear-armed countries here who have a long history of quite strong hatred and skirmishes and wars. Once again, you know, pretty much boiling out of control. And I've just pulled this story from the Greens Party here in Australia, which is, you know, a kind of liberal kind of party here. This is by Senator Scott Ludlam. It's called Foreign Minister in Denial on India's Nuclear Record. Australian Foreign Minister Bob Carr's defence of India's non-proliferation record defies belief as well as history, as the Australian Greens said today. Quote, it is ridiculous for Bob Carr to defend India's non-proliferation record when India produced plutonium for weapons in 1974 from a Canadian-supplied reactor it pledged to only use for peaceful purposes. The foreign minister has forgotten that Australia also played a leading role in establishing the nuclear supplies group in direct response to this duplicity. The foreign minister has also forgotten that K. Subramaniam, I apologise for any pronunciation, former head of the National Security Advisory Board in India said in 2005, and I quote, given India's uranium ore crunch and the need to build up our nuclear deterrent arsenal as fast as possible, it is in India's advantage to categorise as many power reactors as possible as civilian ones to be refueled by imported uranium and to conserve our native uranium fuel for weapons-grade plutonium production. Clearly, Australian uranium would boost India's nuclear weapons capacity. James, this whole story comes from an agreement that was put forward by the Gillard administration, I believe, about October last year. They signed up to, you know, essentially got the wheels in motion for this deal to supply uranium to India. This is a country that has not signed on to the non-proliferation treaty. And it's, to me, the hypocrisy poses, you know, it has no bounds, considering that we have Australia and the Western world wagging its finger at Iran, and I'm not here waving an Ahmadinejad flag or anything, but here we have Australia going to supply a nation that is well known to have nuclear arms, has tested recently ballistic nuclear missiles, and has a long hatred with another nuclear armed nation in Pakistan.
That's right. I mean, it's a simmering pot of tensions there between, obviously, India and Pakistan. They've been at each other's throats since their inception. And it is, I think, one of those disputes that is really underreported, considering how important it is. And it's just kind of mind-boggling that you have these two nuclear powers that have been really holding themselves back from attacking each other for decades now, and no one seems to really talk about these tensions or how they play into the broader geopolitical mix. And everyone, of course, has their eyes on Iran as a possible flashpoint for some sort of World War III, and rightly so. I mean, it is certainly something that we have to be aware of, but India-Pakistan is another place where it could come out of left field, and who knows what might start off a broader war. So I think it is important for us to keep an eye on that. And yes, I suppose it's not Asia-Pacific per se, but it is certainly part of Asia, and it does spill over into the region. So a very important story.
Yeah, and just to go on what you said about underreported, I actually found this story in a local paper in the middle of the paper on one small paragraph at the bottom of a page. Basically, the headline was India and Pakistan told to prepare for nuclear war. And I just kind of, it just threw me off how crazy it was that this is such a massive story and it's literally only worth a paragraph in a local paper.
Such is the way of international geopolitics, and I guess we shouldn't be surprised that stories like that can deserve a tiny mention, whereas other stories get blown up. But it is always interesting to see that. So I think this is something we should have our eye on, and we should keep our eye on it for potential flare-ups in the future.
I totally agree. All right, James, I think that will do it for this month. I'm very much looking forward to, once again, I'm very excited about this series and looking forward to next month to going over some more issues as, you know, things are increasing here rapidly. So look forward to speaking with you then.
I'm looking forward to it too. And let's just remind people once again that you're at apperspective.net, and I hope people are checking that website on a regular basis for these types of updates. So Brock, thank you for your time.
Always a pleasure. See you next month.